I'm Tammy Vindonge, your host for Executive with a Cause. Today on the show, I welcome Dr. Debbie Saunders, the founder and CEO and chief remote pilot of Wildlife Drones. Today, we're going to chat about the good, bad, and hard things about running a social enterprise. Debbie, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I think we met a couple of years ago at a Canberra Business Innovation Network event. Yeah. Was that right?
Yeah.
And you just started the company at the time, so it was still pretty young.
Yes, absolutely. A couple of years ago, we would have just received our first investment at that point. So that was the very beginning of sort of launching the business, yeah.
Well, for people that are not familiar with Wildlife Drones, can you tell us more about it and why you started it?
Yeah, sure. Wildlife Drones is a sensor technology company, really. So we've developed a unique sensor that can be attached to an off-the-shelf drone that tracks animal movements. And the reason we came up with this idea was that I am a wildlife biologist by trade, and for my research on endangered birds, we really needed to find out where these birds were going and what they were doing, and they're really dynamic in their movements. But we had no way of tracking them. People had tried tracking them by hand, walking around with their arm up in the air, listening for this beep, beep, and then following it essentially one at a time. And anyone trying to track this particular species, which is the swift parrot, had failed. Mm-hmm. And so we needed to come up with a new way. So that was the inspiration for trying to develop some new technology that could search landscapes much more efficiently save people a lot of time and effort. It's really hard work, especially in like mountainous landscapes or in swamps and things like that can be really difficult to get any information at all.
I think most of us would be able to remember some National Geographic film where you see them doing that with this big old pole trying to find whatever monkey they've released.
Yeah, and they're still doing that all around the world. Mm. So it's not changed in about 50 years, the way that people track those animals. So we wanted to change that.
So you said you're a biologist, not a technologist.
No. Yeah.
How did you get the software or the technology to do this?
So I originally started out as a research project where I was the ecologist looking at the bird and its environment, and I sought out people who knew drones. I really wanted to develop the radio tracking side of it, so I wanted somebody who was familiar with drones. I didn't want to reinvent a drone, although this was a very long time ago and there weren't many around. So I just sought out people, and we applied for funding, and it took several years actually before we could get someone to believe in the idea of radio tracking from a drone. And then when we finally got the funding, we proved it was possible, and we were the first people in the world to do so. And so I then started getting contacted by people from all over the world who were doing wildlife research and said, oh my gosh, can I have one of these things as well? But my project had finished. The funding was over, and we also had discovered all the flaws in our system. It was a prototype. It was a research prototype. Many things made it not very practical.
Okay.
But we knew that, you know, it was possible. Right. So I was like, well, you don't actually want what I've just, you know, what we've just done, but I might go and see if I can find, we knew what we needed to do to change that. Uh-huh. But I needed to then find new people because that research project was over, and the people I worked with were field roboticists. So they were really only interested in the robotic side of things. So I was interested in the radio tracking. I'm like, I don't think we need robots out there just yet. I don't think people are ready for that. This was back in 2011. Uh-huh. And so I really want to focus on the radio tracking part and make it an accessible tool before we go robotic. I think we will be robotic again, no doubt. But I think it was important to get the core technology right first. So then I just started seeking out people who might be willing to work for free and have some knowledge. and I approached an RF engineer at Australian National University. Uh-huh. And just said, oh, do you have any students who might like to kind of just join me on this journey? And he was a professor. And he said, well, actually, I would.
Oh, okay.
And so that was a great score. Dr. Gerard Borg, or Professor Gerard Borg, was joined our team. And for a couple of years, when I had my young children at home, we just kind of looked at, okay, well, what do we need to do to address all those problems that we knew about before?
So the original types of tracking that's done, is that also on a radio frequency?
These little tiny tags are radio tags. They are used globally. Okay. So people use them all over the world. Mm-hmm. They're a very standard tool. And they're the only way of tracking. About 70% of the world's wildlife are too small for satellite or GPS tags. So it's, we just wanted to use this. Like, people still use the same technology and they all have their preferred suppliers, et cetera, but have a receiver that could track any of them.
Okay. So the receiver is strong enough to capture even an animal in the remotest tree line.
Yeah, and tiny. It can be really tiny. The smallest tag that we've tracked is 0.3 of a gram.
Wow.
So you have a bat, which is like a micro bat, a tiny, tiny little bat, and they have this tiny little tag, and we can track those right up to big tags. You know, the biggest tags also have radio signals as well.
So I'm interested because when I used to work with animals, those drones were so loud, it would scare all the dogs and cats. How does that work in a conservation space?
Yeah, it's a really good question because I think a lot of people are concerned about harassment, fair enough, because you see those horrific videos on YouTube.
You do.
And with our technology, it's probably one of the most unique in the world in that we actually track the animals from a distance. So we listen. It's a listening drone.
Oh, interesting.
So it's listening for signals. So the signals are going beep, beep. It's the same signal that people have been listening to, but the payload does the listening for them instead. And it actually needs to get a direction. It will do triangulating to locate the animal. So it will listen for a signal in all directions and then put an arrow on a map in real time showing it's that way.
Okay.
And then we don't fly the drone following the arrow. We fly so we're perpendicular to the arrow. And the better those intersecting lines, the more accurate the location that we get. Okay. So we never, like most drone applications are visual and they fly in a lawnmower pattern backwards and forwards and go over the top of everything.
Right.
We don't do that. We keep it a distance and then we're able to get better directions towards the animal.
Interesting. So you actually solved this problem thinking about these constraints to begin with, that you would actually scare the animals and such. I want to go back to the how, because being, once again, you're not a technology person. Mm. You got a radio person involved.
Yep.
So that helped with one aspect, but there's still probably a lot of other technical pieces to this puzzle. How did you find the other resources that you needed?
Yeah, so it was getting the RF engineer was the first step, and so we needed to have that solid RF backing behind whatever we did, and I really didn't know what I was doing, to be honest. So I just relied on them, and I would talk about as an ecologist what this means. He would talk about what RF means, but then we also needed a marketing person, so someone who could actually let people know what we were doing. And so I had a student who was doing science communication, and she volunteered for us for a while, which was like none of us were getting paid for a couple of years, and she was fabulous. Like but we were able to sort of help her with her degree as well. So she was able to advance her career by doing stuff with us. And then we got to a point where we really hit a ceiling in terms of the technological knowledge in the team. We had put other RF engineers on as well, but we really just got to a point where there were issues that we couldn't resolve, and it was getting increasingly frustrating. I'm like, oh no, this is not going to work. We need something to change. So I sort of asked around amongst my friends, and was very fortunate to have a software engineer as a friend who said, oh, look, would you like me to audit the code? And I'm like, yes, that's exactly what I need, because at the moment we can't tease anything apart, so we can't fix it if something goes wrong. So he audited the code for me, and he was like, oh, the bad news is that it's as bad as you think it is.
All these years building this technology was pretty much wasted. Is that what?
No, not wasted, but definitely not wasted, because it's still the hardware was, we'd set up a really core hardware component, but the software had reached its limits of the capability of the people we had on the team.
Right.
So we just needed to figure out how do we disentangle the code.
Okay.
Essentially. And he said the good news was that I know someone who can help you fix it.
Oh, lovely.
And so then we got this person on just on a part-time basis, and got him to review it. And he's like, yep, I can see lots and lots of things that we can do here, and trimmed it down to like a third of what it was. Like, it's very convoluted. You just had to really put your faith in the knowledge of the different people that you're relying on at different times. But we got to a point where we knew what we wanted to do. We wanted to have, I had a design for a user interface, for example. I needed to employ someone who had the knowledge to take it to the next level in the code.
Uh-huh.
Because I don't have those skills, I had to raise funds if I wanted to take it anywhere. So then I embarked on that sort of first investment round journey, which was very long and convoluted as well. Yeah.
Let's talk about that because it's still, especially in the social enterprise space or for-purpose space, it's actually not as well known as far as that pathway. Mm. If you look at a startup that has a very monetary result at the end of it, as you said earlier before we started, impact investing is not nearly as mature. So can you walk us through how you went through that funding round?
Yeah. Well, it was interesting because when you I did a lot of innovation programs, which is how I met you, uh-huh. which is wonderful, and met many other wonderful people as well with a lot of knowledge. And but you hear about the same story about what that path is. You go into an accelerator and then you go to the next thing and you do validation or the rest of it. So I was doing that market research, et cetera, when I was at home part-time with my daughter. And then once she went to school, I'm like, right, okay, I want to do this full-time. And so then I started looking into it and we participated in a CSIRO, like Commonwealth Government innovation event, and we got into that and we connected with some investors through that.
Uh-huh.
But in the end, my lead investor came from a connection on LinkedIn.
Oh, really?
And so I had one venture capital firm through that program that were interested, but I was not part of their core portfolio. And so it was going quite well. And then when I thought I was going to close the round, I dropped to the bottom of their priority list.
Mm.
And I was like, no. I had everything. I had contractors lined up to do the UI. I had software engineers lined up to join the team. I was going to employ my marketing intern so she could be employed by me as well. And I also needed a salary to pay the rent. And so I then reached out to my mentors, who I also met at this Canberra Innovation events, Sylvia Tulloch in particular.
Yep.
And I didn't know, I don't know what to do. I didn't know where to go. And she said, look, just go talk to your other investors that you were talking to and tell them what you just told me. Oh, okay. So then I did. And it was amazing. So one of our other investors, who's an angel investor, doubled his contribution.
Wow.
And all of a sudden, it was possible. And so I think for me, as a researcher who's always applied for grants, my whole career has been grant-based funding, applying, failing, applying again and failing until you're successful. It's a bit similar in the business space, but it can really depend on personal interests and personal passions. And everyone has this different story, their own journey, and different things are important to them. And I find it really fascinating in the business space that you can meet people who just go, I think that's a great idea. Yeah, I'm going to support you. And I was like, wow, it blows my mind still that people will actually give me their money so that I can employ people and, make this dream come true and make this business come true.
Are they doing it with an equity position or are they doing it through debt?
Equity.
Yeah, okay. I think one of the biggest challenges, especially with the early rounds, especially if you haven't shown significant revenue yet, is how much are you willing to give away at that point, right? Mm. So what was that like, having to make that decision?
Well, I think a lot of that decision is not really in your hands. Once somebody invests, they kind of guide, how much equity they want for that money and whether you're happy with that. For me, in that first round, I had no idea about these things, to be honest. I was learning as I was going.
Mm.
But I knew that I couldn't progress without the funding to pay people. And I don't feel comfortable with debt. I've always been kind of quite risk adverse in that sense. And so at that point we might have made one sale. Like we really hadn't, we were in R&D for, a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
And because it is hardware and software, it's quite complex to get a hold of. So it was going to be a while off before I could generate my own revenue, but I still needed to employ people.
Uh-huh.
So I think there's just, I can't remember what the exact percentage was, but it was just, you just kind of say, okay, well, are you happy in order for this to continue? Is that at a level that's acceptable to you? And that's, I think, going to be different for different people. But I have noticed the dilution.
Yeah.
I'm noticing it more and more as I go through the journey. And I do wish I had a bit more savviness about me early on.
What round are you on now?
So we've had two rounds. Okay. And we are looking for a third
funding round. Each time it gets diluted further, doesn't
it? Yeah, and it's quite shocking when you see how much. However, you know, you just see where, you know, how far we've gone and what we've achieved, the value of the business has gone up dramatically in that time. Yeah. So it's a balancing act.
It's interesting with the impact of investing, because you're talking about a social, or in this case, an environmental benefit that sometimes is not measured, but most of the time, not always, most of the time in social enterprises, they're also looking for a return on the investment. So what's the business case for these investors?
So it is a return on their investment. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting, actually, right at the very beginning. So the reason we set up Wildlife Drones, because we won a pitch event. We won the Innovation ACT and we got $10,000. I'm like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. We better set up a bank account. Because there were two of us. I had a friend who joined me really early on. And that's kind of how we became, and just by winning this event. And so I forgot what the question is.
Oh, so the question is for investors. When you're thinking about impact investing, a lot of them think about the social or environmental mission at this point, but they're also looking for a return on their investment. So what was the business case that you gave to investors to say that you would get your money back out of this?
Yeah, that's right. So the idea was that I would give them a return on that investment, that I would make enough profit to be able to return that to them. But I did have to, why I went on that tangent was that we had to kind of just make a decision early on, were we going to be a social enterprise or a not-for-profit and have a committee, or were we going to go down the business path? And to be honest, I just kind of looked at the two and went, it sounds really complex to do a non-profit. I really don't know. I didn't know the people that I would want on a committee, and it sounded like there was a lot more constraints. And I've spent all of my career, I guess, begging for money to do what I want to do, and I could just see that being perpetual. I know how hard that is.
Yeah.
And so I really didn't know what the future was. I was just exploring what was possible at that point. So to me, the business model seemed simpler. And I'm pleased that I went down that path. But in terms of the investors, I mean, my lead investor, he often invests in things that he just feels good about. So he gets some sort of return on that. But I think I also want to become profitable so I can support my team.
Yeah.
And so this is something I guess I didn't as a researcher, I didn't previously have much appreciation of, that you need to to generate income to support yourself, because if you don't charge enough and you don't get enough revenue from that, then you lose your team and everything stops and nobody benefits.
Yeah.
And that's been a very interesting switch in mindset for me as a researcher, where you're always just doing things for the greater good or what have you, or
right.
greater knowledge,
uh-huh.
but all of a sudden you have to turn a profit. But what that means is that the power is put back in your hands, that if you have a product that is of value and people are willing to pay for it and you explore that, and we've pivoted the business and all sorts of things along the way, that you can sustain yourself and support people all around the world. So, you know, as someone who's volunteered, you know, my whole life in various capacities, I do find it hard if an NGO perhaps can't afford our technology, because I feel like, oh, it's not fully accessible. But, you know, one idea I have around that is, once I'm established enough and I'm able to give back, I will.
Yeah.
And I'll be able to support those people who may not be able to afford it themselves.
So who are your customers right now?
So actually, the majority of our customers are governments,
okay.
government departments, so uh-huh. state or federal government, even regional or local uh-huh. as well, but predominantly at the state level. And they're the natural resource managers, so they have to protect endangered species but also control invasive species.
Uh-huh.
So it's sort of both sides of the conservation realm, if you like. And then there's also researchers from universities. In Australia, I find that the uptake isn't as much as in the US. So the US researchers seem more willing to embrace innovative technology. So researchers are definitely the environmental consultants who do impact assessments and things like that. And zoos who do captive breeding programs. So they breed them up and release them back into the wild. And they invest heavily in those animals, and they really need to understand the survival and what they're doing when they're released back into the wild. Yeah, so this is our main segments.
It's interesting because earlier this year I've spoken to Jim Lynch, the founder of Zootlandia, and he was saying that the business case for them was that the cost of eradicating feral animals within their ecostructure to protect the endangered species, whether it be animals or plants, was actually more expensive than for them to build the fence that they built around Wellington. So, you know, it's kind of interesting to see the cause and effect and whether or not governments can see that benefit.
Yeah, and I think this is why governments have been our top client, if you like, because they're paying staff at a good salary rate, and it costs them a fortune to pay for someone to walk around with their arm up in the air for days and days and weeks and months on end, searching for one animal at a time. Yeah. It just doesn't stack up economically than purchasing the kit. And because with the drone, we can track up to 40 animals simultaneously.
Okay.
And all of that data is collected, analyzed, and mapped in real time. And so they can get all the information they need with barely moving anywhere. They can maneuver the drone around. But if they do need to take action, for example, if an animal is injured or dies, the signal changes and we can read that signal. And so we can alert the team on the ground. So if some animal is in that state, they can get someone there straight away.
Wow.
Rather than spending all the time trying to find it in the first instance, they can just go straight there and see what's happened to it, and then they can learn more rapidly about how to prevent that in the future.
Oh, brilliant. Right now, you seem to have a lot of products and services on your website, but you said you've had a pivot a few times to try to find that commercial model. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, so we've had the same product. So we really have one core product, which is the radio tracking sensor that you can attach to a drone. But we do offer services as well, because not everyone is up for becoming a pilot and purchasing drones and all the rigmarole that involves. So we do offer services in both radio tracking and thermal imaging.
Uh-huh.
And so we do a bit of that, but the core business is still our product, because we are still the first to market with that product. But what we have pivoted on is how we get that out to clients, or how they purchase it. So the purchase model. So originally we hired out the system, and they could do short-term or long-term hires, etc. But we found that there was a lot of work getting one system out, and it might just be a 1 month hire.
Right.
And then it comes back, and then you have to actually maintain that and retest it and make sure it's good for the next person. It was, really not very efficient, but also it meant that our clients had to have ongoing revenue streams to pay for it. And so they tended to do short hires.
Yeah.
And we surveyed all our clients and said, would you actually prefer this, or would you prefer like a larger upfront cost plus a smaller subscription for the software updates, et cetera? And like 95% said they would prefer this.
Yeah, interesting.
So we switched. We switched to selling. We did it gradually. So some people were still hiring or whatever, but we just sell now. And we find that there is actually a learning curve as well. And so just doing a really short-term hire, the pressure is on.
Mm.
You know, these people are learning how to fly, how to track without listening for the first time. It's actually a very noisy world, so there's a lot of noise in the environment as well, and you have to decipher sometimes between one thing and another. There's a lot of learning and a lot of investment, and so it doesn't make sense to do a short-term project. It just means that everybody's really under pressure.
You probably had a lot of broken drones coming back too.
No, well, so we don't own the drones. So we just provide the payload they would get their own drone. But everyone thinks that they don't just fall out of the sky all the time. Like, they're pretty amazing. Like, you launch them and they just literally sit there waiting for you to tell them what to do. Mm. They're not hard to fly, but I guess it is easy to crash, but we haven't had many, put it that way.
Well, that's good to know. I can picture the tree lines being littered with them at some point.
We have our original drones from when we started 5 years ago, though. Yeah,
that's good to have. Well, okay, so with the business model, moving to more of a sell, but you still have that ongoing subscription fee.
Yes.
Is that providing the ongoing revenue to keep you sustainable, or is that why you're going through another round of funding? Are you planning to do another, you know, R&D effort?
Yeah, look, I think there's a whole bunch of exciting stuff that we really want to do, because although we started out radio tracking, it's a very particular task, you
right.
know, and it tends to be a project-based task. But all of our clients do other environmental monitoring as well. So they will actually be using acoustic monitors, so things that record sound. They were doing camera traps to record vision.
Uh-huh.
The drones have both normal cameras and thermal cameras. So there's all of these sensors that are being used everywhere around the world, and everybody's collecting the data manually.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about this.
They have to walk around. And in some places, that alone is really hard, and collect the data off every SD card and try not to drop it in the leaf litter in the pouring rain or whatever. And so there's this massive data that's been collected manually. It's incredibly slow and expensive to get it. But then once you've got it, actually processing it is another whole sort of workload, if you like, and then trying to make sense of it
yeah.
as well.
Yeah.
So our vision is actually to have like a complete environmental monitoring solution from one platform. So this is just the beginning. And the radio tracking system, really what it is an onboard computer, a real-time communication system, and an antenna that enables data upload. So what we want to do is collect more data from different sensors from the same platform, and then sync that all to the cloud, build in some AI, machine learning for all the different aspects that people are interested in accounting for, and getting reporting and analytics and other things in the cloud as well. So our aim is to have the hardware that we sell really just becomes the enabling technology.
Uh-huh.
And then the software is where all of those really great benefits come. There's so much data out there that people then need to wade through. And with the radio tracking stuff, we always wanted to have it real time, analyzed in real time, because you need to take action on the ground in the field, even if you don't have internet connectivity.
Yeah.
So at the moment, that's what we have. And what we want to do is scale that up so that every single day people can use this solution to collect data in a repeatable scientific way, but then also have it analyzed in real time. And so people can go and do what they need to do. And it's not taking over from people, but it's taking the baseline data collection into a more streamlined process, so that people can then go and do the other things that only people can do, like observe behavior yeah. and
make decisions.
Other things, make decisions,
yeah,
yeah, and plan, as everything's changing rapidly.
Yeah. Well, I think there's probably, like you say, so much value. There's just about every charity and not-for-profit would tell you they have more data than they can possibly process, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And so it's not unusual to have this issue, but it's a matter of being able to find a solution that can meet their needs. If you could find one that meets a lot of organizations' needs at once and provide them with a real-time dashboard to make those decisions on the fly, I mean, how brilliant would that be?
Yeah, and our vision is really to have at the moment we're working with quadcopter drones, so it just looks like a mini helicopter kind of thing with four rotors, but we really would love to get onto a vertical takeoff and land platform, so it's like a fixed-wing drone, but it can take off vertically. So what we want to be able to do is to be able to launch and land on a 1 meter square kind of area, but then fly for a couple of hours. So you can just get the scale that you need for a lot of monitoring projects. You can be up in the air for a couple of hours, and you can do it day or night. So you can collect thermal imagery, RGB imagery during the day, and launch and land and recharge.
Do they exist already?
They do.
Okay.
And this is the thing. I think there's all these bits and pieces exist, but nobody's put them all together.
You're the integrator.
And there are systems. There's one docking station I know of. It's for a VTOL drone, and it looks beautiful, and I'd love one. Can't afford one just yet. But there's a whole range of these platforms. They're becoming more and more common. They're being used extensively in drone deliveries.
Because that is more beneficial to get your coffee that way.
Well, I'm thinking more about, in Africa, where they don't have much impact. infrastructure.
Yeah, yeah.
Drone deliveries are becoming a bigger and more important thing for medical deliveries, that type of thing.
Yeah.
And I just have this vision of these drones are delivering medical supplies, but they're tracking to make sure that the rhinos haven't been poached en route.
Why not? Right?
Like, yeah. You know, there's this platform in the air and we should be maximizing what we can do from that platform. So, I'm kind of just exploring that at the moment.
The partnerships are on the
way. Yeah. There's so much action in this space, but most of it isn't focused on conservation. And, we'd like to change that.
Mm. Do you have any results from the work that you've done so far in the conservation part of it?
Look, a lot of our clients are working on long-term projects. And so it's kind of interesting because there's a lot of them are researchers, whether they're in government or universities. And they're getting results and they're using it, but they're not really publishing it because they're applying that on the ground every day. Their interest isn't necessarily the publishing of the papers or their three-year projects.
Right.
And so we haven't got that many publications in the scientific literature yet because it's, all these things take time.
Yeah,
it just takes time.
I mean, Jim Lynch, going back to that show, he had said that it was first a 30-year plan, but really it was a 500-year plan.
Exactly.
And he actually had it written down. So conservation is not a short-term fix.
No, it never is. And that's, same with our clients. There's a long lead time for most of our clients. They're just discovering. When you're doing something for the first time, people have to learn about what it is, what's actually possible now. And then now I need to apply for funding to make that possible.
Yeah.
And so there is this sort of journey that we join them on.
It seems to me that would be probably part of the issue as well, that you have to educate them that there's another way to do it and then wait till they get the money.
Yeah, absolutely. So educating, then helping them get the funding, perhaps. Like we sometimes give them excerpts for ethics applications, for example, on actually how it's more beneficial to do it from a drone, more ethical, in fact, in many cases. So I've been through that process myself, so I'm able to kind of just help them along. I understand the grant process, what have you. And in government, I have worked in government as well, so the procurement process in government, you just have to smile and fill in those forms.
Good old RFT. We love them, don't we?
Yeah.
I'm curious if you had any goals around actually selling the data. Like it's one thing to be able to provide them with a platform so they can make decisions around that. But it seems like the data itself, especially when we're thinking about climate change, how valuable that could be, being able to track that much information across so many different places.
Yeah, and this was one of the things. So at the moment, the bulk of the price of the product is the hardware, and there's a small software subscription because we don't have it synced to the cloud at the moment, and we don't have those extra add-on capabilities. But such a valuable database to have all these different species in different landscapes that are all being impacted in different ways and being able to learn from that at a global scale. However, for some clients, that's their data.
Of course.
And we don't have it. You know, it's not ours, it's theirs. But if they're open to sharing, then we have the great fortune to work with that data, to advance our code, to optimize it for all these different situations so that we can improve it for clients moving forward, but also, piece together bits of the puzzle that aren't available anywhere else. So the data has always been there as like a long-term goal, that is one of the key things. And as we offer more and more capability in the cloud and the data services, then there's add-ons to subscriptions that people can have to add extra value to their projects.
Yeah. Look, fascinating to watch your business evolve because, like you said, I think the first time we met was really early on, and now seeing it now getting to this next step of technology, which is fascinating. It's really such an interesting time. I'd actually love to have you back, assuming the show's still going, in a couple of years, to find out how it went, because it seems like there's going to be something to share at that point in time about whether or not you're able to advance the technology further. And I could even think of use cases where you have different government agencies all tracking different types of migrations, whether it be a bird or something else. And all that together is showing a story that wouldn't be possible to share otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've, so we're now looking at expanding more into the US. And so we we just started getting pull from the US. So people started finding us and discovering what was possible. And then they were like, I really want this system. Okay. So we quickly, you know, hustled together and made sure we got our compliance done and all the rest of it so we could begin exporting to the US. And now we're about to look for our first staff member in the US.
Wow,
so
okay.
That's the next step for
so
us.
So are you setting up an actual physical company there?
Not yet.
Okay.
I've done a number of export boot camps for the US, uh-huh. which have been really informative of what is involved in doing that.
It's not
and
small.
It's huge. So that's part of what we're looking for in the next investment round is to enable us to establish the business properly in the US. Uh-huh. So in the meantime, it will be just on a smaller scale with one or two people and you know, just get a bit more momentum. I think one of the concerns is that we're starting to get clients on the East Coast of the US and the time difference is shocking.
Yes.
It's like almost polar opposite.
It's 14 hours. I know because I've had to talk to a potential client that way recently. Are you, how many employees do you have right now?
So we've got six.
Six full-time employees and very high-skilled people. So this is challenging.
Yeah.
And then with the initiatives you're trying to put in place now, how big will your team grow if you get that next funding round?
So we would be looking at getting up to about 10 or 12 people, like within 12 months.
Doubling in size.
Yeah, within 12 months if we get that funding and then growing further, but not continuing to double. Well, it might, I guess, if it takes off.
I'm sure your investors would love that.
But I don't think you don't necessarily need to double the staff to double the revenue, for example.
Yeah.
So I think that we can do a lot with the people we have. We have all the core members that we need to do all the different aspects of the business. We just need that extra salesperson in the US because it's a much bigger market.
Oh, yeah.
And just having somebody on the ground over there, I think.
They'll be moving around quite a bit.
Yeah.
The size of America as well. Do you have anything else that you want to share about your future plans?
So as we just kind of referred to, we are looking for further investment. We're really keen for impact investors to join us on this round.
Okay.
And so people who are interested in the biodiversity side of it, in the conservation, and just understand that part of the business. And I think that one of my challenges in this realm is being able to tell the story of what that market is. It's really challenging to pull together that information, the typical information that investors see about market sizes and things simply don't exist for my industry right now because we're at the leading edge. So you have to get quite creative about how you determine that market size. But I'm reaching out to more and more impact investors. And so if anyone is interested in like joining the journey or at least having a discussion about where we're up to and what our plans are, you know, it'd be awesome to have some people that really connect with the business and are aligned with the business. Mm-hmm. We don't just want investors' money and nothing else. I think the biggest thing with investment is getting the right people.
Yeah.
Much like the team, you have to have the right people or everything falls apart.
Well, yeah. And I think that the mission is, it's the reason why you're a social enterprise and not just a normal business, right? The mission itself is so loud and so important to you that just to achieve a financial return is not good enough.
Mm, absolutely. And I think that, you know, there's been all these increasing number of reports lately, like the World Economic Forum and United Nations, and just like biodiversity loss is in the top five risks to our global economy, to our global way of life.
Yeah.
And it needs to be addressed and it's not being taken seriously yet.
Mm.
But there's a market there and it's growing and I want to be at the front of it.
Well, I think you are. I think you absolutely are in the front of it. So it'll be really exciting to hear your stories in the future. If people do want to reach out to you or the organization, what's the best way to do that?
You can look up Wildlife Drones online.
.com.org.
It's .net.
.net. Okay.
.net. Yeah, wildlifedrones.net. And there's contact forms on there. There's phone numbers that you can call or email or send us a message anyway that you want to or social media. We're on all of the channels, LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, etc.
Terrific.
And you can check out YouTube. We've got lots of little videos, 2-minute videos of client projects and the sort of value that people are getting out of their out of our technology for a whole raft of different creatures around the world.
I'm sure the person who's used to holding their hand up for a very long periods of time with that little pole at the end of it is probably the most benefited from this type of project. So yeah, check out these things. We'll put the links in the show notes. Debbie, thank you for your time today, and thank you for the work that you guys are doing around conservation, recognizing this is a business, but obviously with a big heart for what you do. And hopefully we'll be able to find some impact investors for you.
Thank you. It's been really wonderful. Thanks for the opportunity.
Cheers. Hi, this is Tammy again. When I'm not doing podcasts, I'm helping not-for-profits with IT decisions. The question for this week's IT in Plain English segment is, what's an API and why is it important for data integrations? An API stands for Application Programming Interface. It's essentially a bridge between two software applications or databases that allow them to talk to each other. Each side of the bridge has different rules about what information can be shared and how it's shared. As an example, you might have an API between your payroll and finance system that allows your fortnightly payroll amounts to be shared automatically. Or your CRM might have an API with providers like SurveyMonkey or Campaign Monitor so that you can send out emails to the people in your database. Most of the modern cloud-based applications have easy-to-connect APIs built into their software. Where I see most of the problems is with legacy systems that still reside on servers in your buildings. These older systems usually require significant work to build and maintain bridges to others. As a result, many organizations just don't do it. And their staff are usually burdened with significant manual processes as a result, with limited cross-system information to make decisions. If this sounds like your organization, it's probably time to consider some upgrades. So there you have it, in plain English. If you have an IT question you want answered, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn and send me a message. I just might answer it on the show. And if you like what you've heard, please subscribe and leave me a review. To all of you executives with a cause, the world is definitely a better place because of you. Thank you for what you and your teams do every day.